Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, August 17th, 2001. In the fireside room this morning is Randall Mullins. Today's session number is MUR 2001-10, and it's titled The Gift of the Enemy. Let's listen in.
Thank you for coming. This is the last of 10 opportunities of what has been a feast of a teaching experience for me. Usually when I teach this material, people are not, you know, the phone's not ringing off the wall to learn about nonviolence. I wish it were, but it's usually taught, you know, once a week in churches. So to get to do this every day for just about for 2 weeks and then engage in conversations and hear just amazing stories, I have learned four times as much as I've taught, and I will go home a lot more in touch with reality as I teach this stuff from having been here. So I've been so grateful for this opportunity. If you're new and don't know it, there are hearing assistive devices. Some of us need that. They're in the, if that would help anyone, they're in the media office just right across the hall here. Most of these sessions are taped. You can order tapes of the sessions through the bookstore. And I think there's also a checkout way you can listen to them here. If you just ask around, you'll find you can listen to them here while you're here at Holden. If some of you are from the Seattle area, I'm teaching this course again in the fall through the Center for Contemplation and Nonviolence, which I direct, and in the Wallingford neighborhood. And we're hoping to have this to be a series where people from many churches and traditions can come together, and I find that in the peace and justice work in Seattle, at least, perhaps in other cities, is we get together and we work and we do busy stuff, but we don't have all that much time to pray and study and really kind of keep strengthening the foundation. So that's part of the hope of that. I also want to mention, yes, the copies are gone that I got, but the Lutheran Peace Fellowship. I've worked with Glenn Gerstmel closely in a number of ways. It happens to be based at Central Lutheran Church in Seattle, but incredible, of the mainline denominations, by far, I think, the best peace fellowship due to Glenn's organization. So here's one flyer about it. There's also a lot more information in the little foyer up in the dining hall that you can get the address. But excellent, excellent work for Lutherans. And the bookstore has two books by Wenck. This one is The Powers That Be. It's kind of a briefer version that pulls together a whole lot of four or five books on Wenck. Engaging the Powers, a little bigger, and it's the book that's really got the most. And so if you're drawn enough to this, the buy a book, these are two good ones, especially getting these if you have a thought of giving one to your church library. This one works as a kind of a reference book. He's done a great job of putting biblical references in the back. It's very well indexed. The footnotes are arranged by page number, and he does a lot of good work in the footnotes so he doesn't interrupt the flow of the, he didn't do it, but Fortress Press, is that a Lutheran publisher?
Yes.
Well, thank you, Fortress Press. I just, on the last day, I finally realized it's the Lutheran publishers that brought us this book I've been talking about. There are other books by Wenck up here. I won't go into all of them. Another good book to start with that's about 80 pages, I guess, is Violence and Nonviolence in South Africa. Wenck calls this the fourth book in his trilogy, but it was, most of you know by now, but for those who are new, it was written in 86 and sent kind of clandestinely to many priests and pastors in South Africa when they were really trying to decide what's the strategy that's going to pull down apartheid. And so this book had quite an impact on the movement of things. Well, today is perhaps the most difficult and the most important dimension of Wenck's work. And here's what he says about it. The gift of the enemy. I submit that the ultimate religious question today should no longer be the Reformation's question, how can I find a gracious God? But rather, how can we find God in our enemies? Let me start. When I was in vacation Bible school back in the Southern Baptist Church, we always had a character story. So I want to start with a story. I think this is one story that is in the powers that be that is not in engaging the powers. So listen to this. Story from Lincoln, Nebraska. On a Sunday morning in June 1991, Cantor Michael Weiser and his wife Julie were unpacking boxes in their new home when the phone rang. "You'll be sorry you ever moved into 5810 Randolph Street, Jew boy," the voice said and hung up. 2 days later, the Weisers received a manila packet in the mail. "The KKK is watching you, scum," read the note. Inside were pictures of Adolf Hitler, caricatures of Jews with hooked noses, blacks with gorilla heads, and graphic depictions of dead blacks and Jews. "The Hollow Hoax was nothing compared to what's going to happen to you," read one note. The Weisers called the police, who said it looked like the work of Larry Trapp, the state leader or grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. A Nazi sympathizer, he had a cadre of skinheads and Klansmen responsible for terrorizing black, Asian, and Jewish families in Nebraska and nearby Iowa. "He's dangerous," the police warned. "We know he makes explosives." Although confined to a wheelchair because of late-stage diabetes, Trapp, 44, was a suspect in the firebombings of several African-Americans' homes around Lincoln and was responsible for what he called Operation Gooks, the March 1991 burning of the Indo-Chinese Refugee Assistance Center in Omaha. He later admitted to these crimes. And Trapp was planning to blow up the synagogue where Weiser was the spiritual leader. Trapp lived alone in a drab efficiency apartment. On one wall, he kept a giant Nazi flag and a double life-size picture of Hitler. Next to these hung his white Klan robe with its red belt and hood. He kept assault rifles, pistols, and shotguns within instant reach for the moment when his enemies might come crashing through the door to kill him. In the rear was a secret bunker he'd built for the coming race wars. When Trapp launched a white supremacist TV series on a local public access cable channel featuring men and women saluting a burning swastika and firing automatic weapons, Michael Weiser was incensed. He called Trapp's KKK hotline and left a message on the answering machine. "Larry," he said, "do you know that the very first laws that Hitler's Nazis passed were against people like yourself who had no legs or who had physical deformities or physical handicaps? Do you realize that you would have been among the first to die under Hitler? Why do you love the Nazis so much?" And he hung up. Weiser continued the calls to the machine. Then one day Trapp picked up. "What the F do you want?" he shouted. "I just want to talk to you," said Weiser. "You black?" Trapp demanded. "Jewish," Weiser replied. "Stop harassing me," said Trapp, who demanded to know why he was calling. Weiser remembered a suggestion of his wife's. "Well, I was thinking you might need a hand with something, and I wondered if I could help," Weiser ventured. "I know you're in a wheelchair, and I thought maybe I could take you to the grocery store." Something like that. Trapp was too stunned to speak. Then he cleared his throat. "That's okay," he said. "That's nice of you, but I got that covered. Thanks anyway, but don't call this number anymore." "I'll be in touch," Weiser replied. During a later call, Trapp admitted that he was rethinking a few things. But then he went back on the radio, spewing the same old hatreds. Furious, Weiser picked up the phone. It's clear you're not rethinking anything at all. After calling Trapp a liar and hypocrite, Weiser demanded an explanation. In a surprisingly tremulous voice, Trapp said, "I'm sorry I did that. I've been talking like that all of my life. I can't help it. I apologize." That evening, the cantor led his congregation in prayers for the Grand Dragon. The next evening, the phone rang at the Weiser's home. "I want to get out," Trapp said, "but I don't know how." The Weisers offered to go over to Trapp's that night to break bread. Trapp hesitated, then agreed, telling them he lived in apartment number 3. When the Weisers entered Trapp's apartment, he burst into tears and tugged off his 2 swastika rings. Soon all 3 were crying, then laughing, then hugging. Trapp resigned from all his racist organizations and wrote apologies to the many people he had threatened or abused. When a few months later Trapp learned that he had less than a year to live, the Weisers invited him to move into their 2-bedroom, 3-children home. When his condition deteriorated, Julie quit her job as a nurse to care for him, sometimes all night. 6 months later, he converted to Judaism. 3 months later, after that, he died. And just want to add a brief story of my own. My upbringing was steeped in racism. I mean, my church, my Southern Baptist church, this is certainly not all Southern Baptist church, and a lot has changed. Some things haven't. But I sat in as a child on deacons' meetings where they talked about how we're going to keep them out if blacks try to come to our church. My coaches, I was a varsity athlete in high school, my coaches talk overt, vicious racism. Most of my teachers, 1 or 2 brave ones, tried to get a different voice in, but it was hard. And my family, my grandfather, who was a great hero to me and a spiritual figure. This is not, I hesitate to tell the part of him that was so taken in by racist demonology, because he's a beautiful man. He was a beautiful man, but he told me stories about the KKK. So I was raised on it, and one of the things a friend and I love to do is, ride through black neighborhoods as teenagers and taunt black people. I mean, it was fun. I mean, that's what we did. And then things started to happen. I went to this little college, and the 1 of 2 black teammates on the football team refused service at a restaurant about 2 blocks from the college. And I saw Lorenzo Childress stand up in front of the whole student body and ask who will come march with me. I thought that was kind of humorous, you know. I didn't think much of that. But now I know in retrospect. And then my sophomore year, Dr. King was killed in Memphis, where I was going to college, my hometown. And then my life just began to turn around. And to fast forward a little bit, I found myself going to black churches all over town and ended up teaching 2 years in an inner city all-black high school right out of college. And I went to this one church. It was a Pentecostal church, kind of a big one, and I still remember the wonderful scene of the pastor was sitting in a big robe on a very high up platform with kind of a throne, king-like quality in this church, you know, and I was the only white person there. And after all of that, a beautiful lay leader of the church stood up to welcome the visitors. And he says, today, we have a member. I still remember what he said. 1970. Today, we have a member of the other race here with us. And we just want him to know how glad we are he's here with us. So, you know, there it was. All the people I'd been taught to hate and put down and think of lower, you know, loving me, you know, and my students at the high school did the same thing, and so that conversion goes on, and I wish I could say that all the residues of racism have gone away, but they haven't. So this process is ongoing. Well, why in the work of nonviolence is it so important to love our enemies? Why is this, we ain't very strong on this point. Without this element, nonviolence is almost worthless, is what he seems to be saying. He says, and nonviolence can be used to make us look good and the mean people look awful. We can use it as another tool of violence, I really do believe. I believe the tools, the weapons of nonviolence are that good. So when I was a fundamentalist child, very religious kid, by the way, very prayerful, we had daily Bible readings in the Southern Baptist Church, and I was raised on sermons like, I remember one sermon illustration from my childhood is, have you ever had one drop of hot grease burn you in the kitchen? You know what that feels like? How would you like to burn like that for all eternity? I went down that altar call a number of times, you know. I always thought that probably not the most psychologically healthy religion, but it probably helped me, kept me out of juvenile crime. I don't know. But I also read my daily Bible readings and remember I read the King James Version in those days. Be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. And I remember I was so afraid of God. I had such a fearful sense of God as about a 9 or 10 year old child. I could not sleep on my back because that meant to me I had to face God, and I knew I wasn't perfect. Well, others before him, but Wink in the most succinct, helpful way has really healed me of that scripture, Matthew 5:48. What does it mean? And Wink just goes on to say that the perfectionistic religion and attitudes and psychologies is an enemy of nonviolence, and that Jesus could not have said that, because in neither Hebrew nor Greek thought was perfection, except in maybe in works of art and in some other very conditional ways. Perfection just wasn't a concept. That wasn't one of the options. So why did we get this translation of this? Boy, I'm learning from all of this. We really need to relook at a whole lot of translations in Scripture. I mean, it's been done in a lot of ways in a lot of languages, and boy, there are no guarantees that what we read is what it meant and said. So what is that verse all about, and what is it trying to say? Well, first of all, Wink makes the point that the whole, you know, we in the especially in Reform and Free Church traditions, we made so much of, you know, salvation by grace. It is the gift of God, lest any man or woman should boast. But that didn't stop the Enlightenment. 1700s, especially 1800s, from developing this sense of perfectionistic stuff. And so it really got into our culture, into our theology, and I guess it got into our biblical translators is what happened. But perfectionism needs an enemy. It needs someone else who's not perfect to show that I am. Perfectionism, of course, is also an enemy of what it means to be human, what it means to be creative and earthy and down to earth, is that we're here as a part of a larger whole and we're connected to each other. So that's one dimension, one demon, I will say, in our spirituality and in our cultural spirituality, that nonviolence helps dissolve, and that we will all find ourselves happier, peaceful people, more peaceful people without. Another concept throughout Wink's work and the background to it, especially beginning with the French philosopher René Girard, whose work I don't know well, but he's certainly seminal in this work of nonviolence. Girard was a French philosopher who was not a Christian until he realized in all of the centuries of the almost archetypical sense of the scapegoat, which is of course very literal in the Hebrew scriptures, that Christianity just turned that upside down and made the scapegoat, instead of someone to get rid of, into the salvific figure, Jesus. You know, we're projecting all the evil onto this person on the cross and killing him, and then with the resurrection. And he said, this is different than what any other culture has done with scapegoat. And so Girard became a Christian. And I think we do that pretty well, and I think my sense is that, let me just test this with you, I think we know it. We know that the scapegoat controls our theology and our spiritualities for generation after generation. We know it, and we get caught in it again. Let me just test it a little bit. Well, where have we projected, can you name some groups or people or individuals where we've projected all of our evil as American culture anywhere in our history? Just a few.
George Bush Senior standing up and saying Saddam Hussein.
Uh-huh.
The devil.
Okay.
Gaddafi.
Reagan?
Reagan saying that Russia was the evil empire.
Uh-huh. Russia was the evil empire. Many of us were raised on bomb drills, and they're going to come get us.
Oh, King George III was the devil incarnate.
King George III.
Years ago.
Yep.
Irish Catholic immigrants. Japanese immigrants. Mexican immigrants.
Japanese immigrants. You're hearing these.
Southeast Asians.
Uh-huh.
Alcohol during Prohibition.
Yeah.
Jane Fonda.
Wait a minute.
She was demonized.
Well, what happened to me, and this week I've been reading a wonderful book called Dreamwork by Jeremy Taylor, who was a Unitarian professor, one of my seminary professors in Berkeley, and just an incredible teacher. And he wrote this book in 1983. It's in the Holden Library here, but I'd never read it all the way through until I got here. But I remember when I was in Jeremy's class, all we did in that class, was tell our dreams and talk about them. We kept a dream journal. We talked about our dream with Jeremy for facilitating an incredible experience. And I remember that was 1975, 76. So it would have been early 76. I just had a wave of dreams about Richard Nixon. He was just recurrent in my dreams. What's this SOB doing in my dreams? I don't want him around. You know, the enemy, the symbol of the shadow, that part of us that we don't want to see. And Jeremy, not a Christian, but boy, does he ever understand us, you know, is saying just what Jesus said, is the psyche is always trying to bring us wholeness. It's at work within us. And the integrity of this book and of this scholar is, there's a chapter in the book called Monitoring Our Own Inner Violence. And a lot of that chapter is Walter Wink's dream journal, struggling with his own encounters with oppression and his own violence, and doing his inner work as well as his head work. And we don't get that all that often. And well, I guess the truth is, I guess we're getting it more and more often in biblical scholarship now. But so much of our culture is still caught in one place. Well, let me read one more thing and then be quiet and see if I can learn to listen. I've been in, some of you know by now, I've been involved the last 5 years very deeply in the Seattle Network's efforts to end the sanctions against the people of Iraq. And this is where I believe the scapegoat thing is happening again. I went to Iraq in 1997, and by the way, if you go to Iraq, you know, Saddam Hussein, big, giant pictures of him are just everywhere. I mean, it's clearly a police state with a man with an incredible, you know, psychotic ego. But there was one picture of him that I took a picture of the picture and made a slide out of, and I'm not sure why to this day. But it's Saddam Hussein, and I think he had a business suit on, smiling big, and he's holding this beautiful child. It is the most beautiful picture of Saddam Hussein. And it just kind of hold that image of Saddam Hussein. And listen as I read the words of Christine Swenson, tell you who she is. She's a member of Central Lutheran Church in Seattle right now, and she's on the staff of Seattle University in public relations. The background to this is May 17th, 2000, just about, 15 months ago, some of the regular, and we are still regularly bombing Iraq. I assume many of you know that, but we don't see it much in the news. But a bomber was making its daily bombing run, dropped a bomb in a barley field just outside the village of Takal Ghazalat, and the bomb decapitated and instantly killed Omran Harbi Jawar, a 13-year-old boy, while he was tending his family's herd of sheep. Shrapnel killed 30 of his sheep and left 5 more youth unconscious and seriously wounded. Well, and that gave rise to an Omran bus tour that I think is still touring the country trying to tell the story after this young man. And it also inspired Christine Swenson to go to Iraq in January and visit the mother of the family of this young man who was killed. Mark and I stepped off the bus into a crowd of villagers. In the center stood Falah, Omran's oldest brother, a confident 33-year-old man with kind eyes. He invited us to follow him under a canopy of date palms on well-worn dirt paths into a courtyard framed by white mud brick walls. It was empty except for his mother at the far end. She was dressed in a long black covering. Only her eyes were exposed, glancing at us, then looking away. Falah emerged from the doorway of their home carrying a large framed portrait of Omran and stood next to his mother in silence. I began to cry. We introduced ourselves as friends. We told them we had heard the news of their great tragedy and had come to offer our condolences and tell them of a growing movement in the United States to end the sanctions and bombing. We told them about the Remembering Omran bus tour, which is still moving across the country with a small group, telling thousands of people about the horrible suffering in Iraq. We were invited to enter the one-room home, dark on this day as the electricity was out, to meet other members of the family. A large family, we met at least 9 brothers along with some uncles and cousins. We asked to speak with Omran's mother, and a young woman pulled a straw mat and pillows from the shelf for us to sit on the floor. His mother entered and sat. She slowly placed her hand on her heart and explained that since Omran's death, her heart was filled with pain and she could no longer speak. Then she picked up a photo of Omran, kissed it, and gave it to us to keep. Before our visit, the only people they had met from the West had been from the Washington Post 2 weeks after Omran's death. They had never known Americans. "We didn't know you had emotions," Falah said. "Your visit today changes everything." We were standing in the courtyard outside Omran's home when the crowd of villagers suddenly pointed to the sky. I could hear a distant roar and my eyes found the outline of a U.S. warplane flying overhead. They told us this happens every day. This is one of my favorite all-time Lutherans. Since there are probably a few Lutherans in the room, I wanted to be sure you heard Christine's story. And let's just open this conversation up now. And, again, I'll just say, there are no specific guidelines to this. And there are no dumb questions. And there's... How does all this connect with you? What reflections or experiences from your lives does it bring to the surface? Question.
The one that comes to mind, and probably a little bit more day-to-day level, is years ago I was reading a self-help book that basically the author's premise was that if there's someone that you really can't stand, really aggravates you, you should reflect on that person and what it is you can't stand. And invariably, it turns out to be something in yourself that you don't like that that person has been doing.
Invariably. And I was going to do that this morning, and I got wrapped up in stories. Walter says when he and June Wink do these workshops, they often ask people to do just that, is to write down the characteristics of someone you really dislike. And almost invariably, it includes a lot of material in ourselves that we're either blind to or conscious of.
Yeah.
Same stuff.
Going back to the Iraq thing, what is the logic of what we hear through the media that, the oil for food and it seems the inexplicable rationale of the Iraqi government to not distribute that food, and therefore, that's the logic we hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me respond to that and try to say, I believe with Wink now, he's given me language, I believe we are all afflicted with a disease and a religion, a diseased religion that he gives a name for, redemptive violence, that It seeps into our culture, into our children's games, into our television, our schools, our churches, and it takes over our DNA. Like one guy said about South African, said about apartheid, he says, "I took in apartheid with my mother's milk." So we take in our self-righteousness, which we're born in this culture. I don't know if even the Amish or the Quakers escaped this, you know. They try in a harder way than some of us do. So that's one part of it, is our psyches are conditioned to hear it in one way. The other part is the media's a part of that. And in spite of that, there's some very brave journalists who would like for it to be different. But just printing lies. It's just lies or lack of the whole truth. They're saying the food's not distributed, and Dennis Halliday, the coordinator of UN relief work in Iraq, said we have tracked it in the villages and with computers, and we think the food distribution in Iraq, this is about 1996 when he said this, so it's a little out of date, but he says the food distribution in Iraq is as equitable and efficient as any UN program anywhere in the world. And so I want to be careful that we don't get further than the group wants to into Iraq. It is an incredibly urgent case study now. And as I probably said last night, it feels urgent to me because unlike after World War II when we won and then the Marshall Plan went into existence and we created friends and markets, we were a little more compassionate capitalists in those days. After the Iraq War, when we won even more handily, we have been the primary perpetrators of genocide, of a policy that isn't openly shooting children, but is killing children.
I remember shortly after the war ended, there was something in the paper that they needed $100 million for relief. And there was no way to come up with $100 million. They, you know, just spent $50 billion on the war, and somehow $100 million was beyond the capability to raise.
Isn't the game that we're going to make the population so miserable that they're going to try to get rid of Saddam? I mean, isn't that the game in Washington?
Yeah. And see, that is the, and I can tell you, you know, just what I've been through over the years, and a number that we have a very significant, silent, kind of hidden Iraqi population in Seattle. But I don't know if you remember, but a few months after the war, there was a, and I don't have all the different groups mastered well in Iraq, some of you perhaps do, but there was a, you know, an anti-Saddam group down in the south that was ready to try to overthrow Saddam, and they were expecting U.S. help to do that. Well, that U.S. help never came. A number of those people came to the United States, and a number of them live in Everett, Washington. Well, the poignant thing that, just to show you how sick this religion and this practice can get, there was another in a series of, we better bomb them again. You know, that's happened three or four times since the war. And so a number of us were down at the Seattle Federal Building demonstrating, praying, trying to raise a different voice. And I looked down the plaza and saw some dark-skinned people with little posters in bad English. And I just went down and got into a conversation with all men, about 20 men and some young boys. And they had posters that was saying, this was during Advent, I remember, stop bombing, please stop bombing our families. And it turned out that these people had been members of the opposition, the group that was going to try to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And then, you know, that didn't get support, that failed, it got squashed, and then they came to the United States. So.
I'd like to ask a question a little different line. Mm-hmm. And it's because I'd like some help understanding something that never ever made sense to me. And I'd like to ask about it and then whether it's changing and is there a way to change it or does it seem to be improving kind of thing. I've never understood the connection between the Ku Klux Klan and the Baptist Church. There seems to be 100% correlation between being a Klan member and being a Baptist.
Oh, no, that's not.
I lived in a part of the South for a little bit, and in that place there was.
Yeah. There are certainly many Baptist groups that are arch-conservative, but to make a, my Southern Baptist Church in Memphis, Tennessee was the first church of any denomination in Memphis to take a strong stand on the racial issue. So,
but
the other thing about...
I didn't say all Baptists were Ku Klux Klan members. I said all Ku Klux Klan members were Baptists.
I just don't know. I don't know that. So, but there are, I think what is true in what you're saying, my caution is, I'm sure my defensive Baptist blood is speaking up here.
It's boiling.
But it is just, some courageous Southern Baptist churches in the South have been some of the strongest, and the most numerous denomination among blacks is also Baptist. So, we were singing the same hymns, using the same theology, and we found that out after a while. So they're clearly exceptions. There is clearly, I just don't know enough about it to comment, there's clearly a lot of connections between distorted Christianity and racist groups. So, but I'm just not qualified to say too much about that.
Well, an easy answer would be just correlation. In the areas of the country where we have known the most about the Ku Klux Klan, a large portion of the population is Southern Baptist. So a large portion of lawyers, doctors, clergy, teachers, and Klan's people would be Southern Baptists.
Yeah.
Like if you went through Minnesota and said, why are most of the attorneys Lutherans? Must be something about Lutheranism that makes them true.
Yeah.
Most people are Lutherans.
Yeah. Yeah, back in Tennessee, there are more Baptists than people. I think that seems accurate there. There may be some other parts to this that I just don't know. So,
is there something about the teaching in the Baptist Church that facilitates the
racist attitude?
Yeah.
Again, there are
you're a Southern Baptist, and I get to ask this question.
There's so much variety just within Southern Baptist, and there's probably no denominational name that has more variety in it ethnically and theological than Baptist. There are Primitive Baptist and the American Baptist, and so it just runs the gamut. So I'd just be reluctant to say anything with any clarity.
Switch gears here. What I'm most intrigued by is this concept of the shadow side that Tucker talks about in the flyer and his relationship, to nonviolence. I really agree with that. What I wonder about is what have you found in your experience that helps people admit to that or wake up to it? Because I just know that, like for me in my 40s, I'm just kind of becoming aware of it. It's not something they want to look at.
Yeah.
And even especially on like a government level, what helps people realize that?
Come out of it and be aware and start to see it and deal with it. Or the dream work in the Sonoy people of Malaysia. If a young child has a dream of a tiger chasing him, he's told to turn in the dream and face the tiger. I think that's what it is. Let's open that question up, because I think what will help us turn and face and learn to love the enemy within, and we're coming with assumption, I'm speaking with an assumption here, is the enemy out there, Saddam Hussein, is something in here, in Randall Mullins and in American culture that we haven't learn to love and see. What has helped, and I think we can say fairly, all of us in this room have come from some blindness to some more enlightenment awareness. What helped you?
Well,
can we stay just focused on that question just a minute? And
I think it's being taught, I don't know where along the way, certainly not in my home growing up, but somewhere along the way, kind of getting the information or the understanding that to have personal wellness, to have personal wholeness, is essential to incorporate all the shadow parts. And I think hitherto I had the idea, and many of us had that idea, that in order to be well, that you needed to protect yourself, you know, like, or to protect and defend and put up a wall mm-hmm. somewhere mm-hmm. Between what is good and what is evil. Mm-hmm. And actually, I do think that in our early religious education, that point of view may have been promulgated, mm-hmm. you know. And especially among youth at a certain time in history or among certain denominations that, and I did have an extensive association with the Baptist Church, and I think that kind of thinking that you have to keep yourself pure and you know, kind of put up some kind of defense against darkness, gives us a very false view of wellness and health.
So what I'm hearing, or you can tell me, is really, I can't capture all that, but it's really growing beyond kind of fortress, yeah. I'll call it fortress religious education, something like that.
Something like that.
That come pretty close, and we'll get it up here. Yes. What helped you?
Forgiveness.
Say just a little more.
The place within which I can be weak and be accepted anyway, despite of who I am. And I guess it's the times where I've been able to speak, you know, about those vulnerabilities and those places that I don't particularly admire about myself, but know when I get them out of myself, I know that there's going to be an acceptance and a place of forgiveness and working with me, not just slamming the door. I think about Desmond Tutu and the reconciliation that's going on in South Africa and the stories that come out, you know, and the freedom within which they have to share those stories and to listen to them, how dark and descriptively, you know, how terrible they are. But the power of it, forgiveness has to set people free. And then for me, it's a process, but I feel that the forgiveness is really that which helps me to begin to see that.
Thank you. Jeremy Taylor, my friend in this dream book, says, turning and facing the shadow after a while becomes more like funhouse scary rather than the kind of scary of I'm going to be destroyed completely and I've got to defend myself. So there's even I think we can even grow in our ability to be vulnerable. Yes, what helped?
I think you can't truly love your children unless you can face your shadows, because they'll give you your shadows. They are your shadows.
Being a parent. Oh, there it all is, yes. Talk about that.
Well, I would add to that, because this is what did it for me, is caring for a difficult parent, engaging parent, seeing the parts in them that you don't like, that guess what, or also you.
Tom, can I call on you here? I know you got one.
Well, I don't know if I'm taking it down that line. I'm looking at facing, being face to face with the enemy, actually being in the same room, looking at them, seeing that they are also an image of God, that's the way to break it down. It's not the Saddam Hussein, it's someone I'm in conflict with in my congregation or the workplace. And what I'm thinking of in the workplace is a lesbian woman that I worked with and was friends with. She was taking a trip to Washington, D.C., and someone came to her from our work group and said, you better beware, because a lot of those people are going to be in D.C. D.C., she was going to a march of lesbian and gay people. Beware, a lot of them are going to be there. And she looked at him and said, I am one of those people. And he said, you're one of those people that's going to hell. And we prayed about it in church and came down on her and yelled at her. And she cried and cried. And 10 minutes later, he came and he said, I'm sorry. I know you're not one of those people because I know you and you're a sweet, wonderful person. Now, there are a whole lot of issues behind that, but seeing her face to face, knowing her, he was able to get past, at least for that one person, you're not the enemy. We can do this, human beings. We can do this face-to-face stuff. We can do it in our offices, and we can do it in our churches when we have church fights, and governments can do it for their people. And South Africa did it. They didn't do it perfectly, but a government said, we can't put all the perpetrators of apartheid in prison. We don't have enough prisons, and we got to have a future here. So, and I'll interrupt my sermon. I want to listen some more, but Bill Moyers has done a special on this.
When you mentioned how you had the dream about Nixon, uh-huh. It reminded me that when Nixon died, it made a difference to me more than I thought it would be. It was kind of like there was a hole in a way, and it was kind of like losing an enemy sometimes is an interesting experience, and it reminded me of a line in a book, I think it was Lonesome Dove, and the cowboy's enemy died, and it just devastated him. It wasn't the kind of grief when a friend dies, but it was, he felt so empty because that had been his scapegoat, I suppose. But maybe we choose our enemies at different times in different ways because of something we need to be against. Mm-hmm. And then when one of them dies, it's been
very interesting example. Yeah. Larry,
what? You know, I've thought to myself many times, people like to swim upstream. And against the current, they like to have something to press against, to fight against internally, kind of thing. And when that goes away, I think many times there's an emptiness. I think it's one reason why sometimes victory is so empty, because there's no challenge left.
Yeah. And if we think of the journey, the spiritual journey, I mean, the image of upstream probably works for others of us, but if we think of that in, you know, in the mythology of Odysseus, you know, of encountering the sirens, you know, that tempt us and then kill us, and that's what human life is. It's a continuous journey into that, then that's what the story's talking about. There were some other factors, yes.
I just wanted to say something about Nixon, because he certainly is, you know, in our day and age, you know, like one of the great demons, you know. And I have a little different perspective on that for two reasons. One, for personal reasons, I was a housemate with Julie Nixon. And I knew her and David very well. And so I knew them as people, and I would often overhear her talking to her dad on the telephone, and she just adored him, and you know, he was really her her role model, and she is a wonderful person. So I kind of saw the family from a little different perspective as people. But the other thing that I learned a little bit later on, which made me really, really angry, was that President Eisenhower, who Richard Nixon served as vice president under, and I believe that Richard Nixon was trying very hard to sort of continue in some fashion this great legacy of Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of like, in a way, not a protege, but at least a colleague and continued this great legacy. Eisenhower remains, you know, this sort of great benign hero of the 50s. But in fact, what was going on under his legislation was just abominable. And so it makes me very angry to think that we could have Eisenhower lifted up like he's just this great benign hero and Richard is the demon because Richard Nixon is the demon because in fact, you know, their policies and their thinking and a lot of the ways that they went about doing things are very similar, and actually between the two, I think Eisenhower is more dangerous.
Yeah.
And so the point being that sometimes we just don't have all the information. We just take what's on the surface and we don't know what the background is.
And I, my colleague Killian Noe got an award and when she was back in D.C. and she happened to share with me a picture of her with Bob Dole and the South Dakota presidential candidate in 72, the liberal, and George McGovern. You know, and she said, you know, they're really great friends. And you don't think of George McGovern, but, you know, they were somehow a part of the community of people when she got this award. But to see that, I'm not very good at this, and I appreciate this story, but to really go find some people to be friends with, I know with the, you know, the way, with my preachy, rigid views about war and nonviolence, I need to be friends with more retired military officers, especially people who live through the reality of it. I need to go sit and just say, tell me what it was like. And not, I don't have to agree with them, you know. But that's a growth I'll get to yet. You had something.
Story. I'm not sure exactly how true it is. Was sort of anecdotally about Khrushchev, what he said after President Kennedy was assassinated. He said, "Well, I think I'm going to miss him." So there's that sense that enemies help us define our positions, where we stand on. So there's sort of a benefit of antagonists.
Did you all know that Kennedy and Khrushchev had a private, unofficial correspondence going on during a lot of the Cold War? Khrushchev had an agent in the Soviet embassy in D.C. deliver letters to Kennedy clandestinely. Kennedy had Norman Cousins working through the Vatican, and there was an incredible amount of things going on. It never quite blossomed as we could, but I'm playing a support role in the research, which I hope is going to become a book by a friend on the assassinations of the 60s, and he just did a lecture on JFK. But so there's but when we see more than is often visible, and you know, history in the media is just not going to give us much, you know, when we can get to people who knew the Nixons as people, we see that there was more to it all. Any other? What I was thinking about, Tom, with you, is I'll just say it because it's true for me too, is, and I'm on the board of Journey into Freedom in Portland. One of the things we do is what we call trips of perspective to third world nations, where you go and meet people. I was privileged to have time in Nicaragua and Honduras and a little time in other Central American countries in the 80s. And Tom's church, Wallingford United Methodist, has a partner relationship, as I'm sure many of your congregations do, with a community in Chalatenango in El Salvador. But going, you know, we are such a traveling people, and now we have many, many opportunities to go, as Christine Swenson did, go meet these people, you know. And so I think this is not necessarily the enemy, but it is, you know, getting the human face on what's usually a category or statistics of the poor or the people of Iraq. You know, it's a family in Iraq whose name I know and whose living room I've sat in, and they've served me tea, and I know what it smells like. And so I just encourage that we can travel and get to these places. We've got just a few more minutes here, not more than five or so. What any other reflections from any perspective? Again, just, you know, look at what we generated out of our experience here of how we can move from fortress spirituality and mentality to opening and forgiveness and reconciliation and turning and facing the enemy face to face. So we've all done it, and we can do more of it, is my passion.
You know, I guess maybe that's one of the strengths of the Reformed tradition that you mentioned earlier, is the whole concept of grace.
Yeah.
You know, God is gracious with us, and God is gracious with our enemies, and none of us is perfect. So that really speaks.
Reclaiming Reformed tradition. So yes.
The song comes to mind that was played the other night at Vespers, and it was about this fellow Francis Tolliver who fought in this war after the First World War, I guess. And then it concluded with the German soldiers and the British soldiers on Christmas Eve. You know, there was like a quiet time, and they started singing the Christmas songs on both sides. And then one of the soldiers came across, and they met in the middle. And it was so moving. And I think that it kind of gives a model of how, if we're on opposite sides of the fence with somebody that we're in an argument with, that it's important to find at least one common ground, like one thing that we share in our either common humanity or in our culture or faith or something, some one place where we can meet and share as human beings. And put the war down for a while.
Yes.
Well, in mid-70s, my husband decided to leave Honeywell because they were building torpedoes. Because he heard a priest at Blessed Sacrament who had gone to Northern Ireland, and they invited somebody back, and they just presented him of the Protestant Catholic thing. And so just that one incident changed my husband's heart after 21 years of working in the defense industry. And that's all he did about it was quit that job and got one that he thought was supporting life. And we never got involved in any of the other activism at all. And it certainly was an economic deprivation for our family of five children, but having grown up in the 50s where there was black and there was white, I, you know, since then I've lived in this big gray tunnel, and I'm still really there. We moved to Kitsap Peninsula 4 years ago, and I started taking piano students, and they all had fathers and mothers in the Navy, and those people came and sat in my kitchen and waited for their children. They hugged me. The children loved me. I loved their families. I felt really sorry for them when they were off to the Gulf on their carrier, the Vincent. They emailed me from the Carl Vincent, and it's like, I never have the courage to say, my husband doesn't take defense contracts because I don't know why, but it was like all, they have gone through so much, they really believe they're peacekeepers. And he really believes he's a peacekeeper. And so I was still in this great tunnel.
And it seems to me that we're all in it together. To me, that I have a close friend, a dear friend in my church who is still a Navy commander and has fired a Trident missile and talks about the power of that, you know, an unarmed one in a practice thing. And I realized I knew him for 5 years in the same thing and just had never talked to him about convictions. But I also realized there's, for me, it's something like a kind of a line of consciousness here. And, you know, I just sort of see redemptive violence. This friend's name is Mike, and I don't have a feeling that I'm any less guilty than he is when I get right down to it. I'm paying taxes. In some ways, he's more honest because I hide behind, you know, I support the same violent system with my taxes and all kind of other ways, my oil, and I mean, it's just impossible to escape all of that. And so, you know, I can kind of talk a good game when he's out there. But I guess I do have to believe that decisions like your husband's to say, you know, I can't leave this system completely, but it's like Bishop Leroy Matthiessen in Amarillo, Texas, urged all Catholics who were at the Pantex plant building nuclear weapons to quit, get another job. Now, is that being a good pastor? Put all those good Catholic families in economic jeopardy? And if they quit, are they going to leave the evil that we're doing in this country? I don't think so. But I guess I believe we got to move a little bit, you know? If something happens in the whole spiritual fabric of things when someone resigns, maybe didn't say a word, didn't make a big deal out of, you know, I just can't do this anymore because I think it's wrong. And I think in the UCC, we're more likely in our kind of ultra openness sometimes. I mean, Mike was invited to stand up in church, and maybe that was good. I don't know, you know, in his uniform and talk about why he believes what he's doing is so important, you know, as the commander on a Trident nuclear sub with the firepower of 50 Hiroshimas. How do we do that? Well, he's certainly God's child. If we're saved by grace, he's as saved as I am. God loves him passionately as much as I, you know, there are no class differences here. We're in it together. So I guess we just got to wrestle with this, but I do believe this, the friendship that we're talking about across these lines. Well,
I have a quick question before.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Has there been any studies done on the relationship of violence and the actual product attitude of non-violence to see whether it actually accomplished the goal? Like, I'm thinking of, I know that the bombing of Iraq and so on has not accomplished the goal, that's why we're still there. What I'm thinking of saying is that has there been studies and scientific studies done on those kinds? Relationship of non-violence and the outcome, as well as violence and outcome.
Yes, I think there's more of those, and a lot in Wink's book brings this out. You know, what, for example, if I understand your question correctly, we do have pretty solid statistics since the 1500s of how many people were killed in war, and what percentage of those were civilians. And you know, we have statistics of if you take the specific battles of the struggle of Indian independence from Great Britain, you know, from 1915 to 48, along in there, you know, there were a few thousand people died in there. But it's not difficult to imagine how many more British and Indian people would have died if India had done it, tried to win their independence, nonviolent. Did I hear your question correctly?
Yeah, that's correct.
Said, so we're starting to see, and that's Wink's argument. Not just Wink, by the way, it's also Gene Sharp at his Einstein Institute, I think is based at Harvard. But he's doing the same thing and now starting to negotiate with governments, including the Pentagon, to seriously say there is enough evidence here about this nonviolent approach to defense. We got to look at it. It may be more efficient. Well, the point is, you know, throwing theology and Christianity and everything out the window just from the point of just, you know, good solid defense, minimizing deaths and injuries and protecting ourselves from outside invaders. Nonviolence is more and more being proven to be more efficient. So, and
well,
I think
Vietnam should prove that violence doesn't always work either.
Yeah, and that one of Wink's points is nonviolence won't always work, and it'll probably, wherever violence would have worked, nonviolence would have probably worked, and vice versa. So, yes.
Well, there's such a huge money machine to keep all these weapons going.
Yeah.
That's one of the things. I mean, I just can't believe that these missiles, what is the thing? Anti-missile? Yeah, Star Wars. And that stuff. I mean, I just can't believe that would be effective, but somebody's going to make a ton of money on that stuff. And I think that's one of the things people.
We're working at our church on a faith-based missile system. Give us $1 million and we'll pray that no missiles are there.
You know, I have a faith-based organization myself. I'm collecting $1 million.
I think in probably every city in America, the weapons of war are of great interest to people and to tourists. And here and there, you got the old battleships, and everybody wants to take a tour. And here, you got a museum that's got all this equipment and stuff, and everybody wants to look at that. And so I think that the other aspect of this is the fact that a lot of people seem to be just very inspired by stories of glory and courage and honor and whatever it is that comes out on the battlefield. At first they don't quite get it, but it's there's something more than just whooping your enemy. You know, I think it's there's something excitinger about, you know, using weapons of war to just, I don't know why.
Well, I think part of it is includes swimming upstream in mythology. I'm starting to get a stronger sense of just the archetype of warrior. We need good warriors. But now we're getting stories, and that's why I'm trying to get these stories out. We're getting stories of nonviolent warriors, you know, where the same kind of risk and bravery and vulnerability has to be there, but it satisfies all the deep, visceral hunger to engage and fight for what's good, but without destroying. And that's the kind of warrior Jesus was. I really believe Jesus satisfies that. Let me close with this, because I think it, well, here's what Wink says. This is someone who's lived with it for decades now and lots of parts of it. Christians today can no longer regard war as an extension of policy, but as a dangerous anachronism, destined for oblivion in the new nonviolent order of God. No doubt the objection may be raised that affirmation of nonviolence by the churches would be simplistic, that ethical judgments in the real world are far too complex to adopt a fixed ethical stance. This objection, I must confess, was one of the main reasons I resisted committing myself without reserve to nonviolence for so many years. I have slowly come to see that what the church needs most desperately is precisely such a clear-cut, unambiguous position. The churches need this. Governments will still wrestle with the option of war, and ethicists can perhaps assist them with their decisions. But the church's own witness should be understandable by the smallest child. We oppose violence in all its forms. And we do so because we reject domination. That means the child will recognize no beatings. That means women will hear no battering. That means men will gradually understand no more male supremacy or war. That means everyone will understand no more rape of the environment. The church must affirm nonviolence without reservation because nonviolence is the way God's domination-free order is coming and is already happening. Thank you. Glad to stay around for more conversation. Let's do this first. Thank you for your presence and your wonderful participation.